There really is something there that we don't scientifically fully understand. Physics doesn't fully understand it. Again, a certain state of consciousness, things snap into place and suddenly the universe makes sense to you. That's incredible. That's incredible that something as complicated as the universe can all of a sudden make sense to this mortal brain. You know, it's just there is a frequency upon which when we can tune into, we realize that our brain is part of the universe.
That was Scott Barry Kaufman, and this is Mentally Flexible. Welcome to Mentally Flexible, where we have meaningful conversations to help you build mental flexibility. I'm Tom Parks. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and in each episode, I'll be talking to people who inspire me most on topics related to psychology, mental health, and creativity. My hope is that through these conversations, you'll better understand yourself, others, and the world around you. Thanks for being here, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. My guest today is Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. Scott is a cognitive scientist and humanistic psychologist. He is among the top 1% most cited scientists in the world for his groundbreaking research on intelligence, creativity, and human potential. Dr. Kaufman is the founder and director of the Center for Human Potential and the author of several books, including Transcend, The New Science of Self-Actualization. Scott is also the host of the Psychology Podcast, which frequently ranks as the number one psychology podcast and has over 30 million downloads. Some of the topics we explore in this episode include the influence of individuals like Alan Watts and Abraham Maslow, Scott's latest book, Transcend, and his new sailboat metaphor to understand the hierarchy of needs, how the full vitality of life requires discomfort, areas of Scott's personal growth, vulnerable narcissism, what it's like doing the psychology podcast for almost 10 years, the difference between being love and deficiency love, and the connection between transcendence and spirituality. The psychology podcast was actually one of the first shows I ever listened to almost 10 years ago, and it was influential in my decision to go into this field. It was a real honor getting to speak with Dr. Kaufman and connect with him. I enjoyed how free-flowing this conversation was. It felt like we were just talking at a coffee shop at times. I really appreciate him taking the time to come on my podcast and chat with me and explore some of his ideas. And I appreciate all of you for being here and listening. If it's your first time, welcome. If you'd like to support the show, you can check out some links in the show notes for ways to buy me a coffee, leave a review, or follow me on Instagram. And as always, I just really appreciate you listening. So, okay, well, let's get into this conversation with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. All right, well, yeah, thank you for doing this again. I thought we could start with one really big important question, which is, what the heck were you doing with Arnold Schwarzenegger yesterday?
You know, yesterday was a kind of, was a fascinating day. I work out at Gold's Gym very frequently, and a lot of celebrities go to Gold's Gym. So yesterday, you know, RFK Jr. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went to the bathroom, and when I came back, he had taken my machine. And before I realized who he was, I was like, bro, you know, I was just in the restroom. And he's like, I'm so sorry. And then I realized who he was, and I was like, oh, hey, man. We have a lot of mutual friends. I'm Scott. And we were talking a little bit. And then I walk outside, and there's Schwarzenegger. You know, this is Gold's Gym, you know. I had seen Arnold before many times there, but I'm actually working on a new book right now that's right up his alley. And so I walked up to him and I was like, hey, I just want to introduce myself. I quote you a lot in my new book on victimhood, and And he seemed interested. He's like, he goes, nice, nice. And yeah, we talk a little bit about it. And I study the science of victimhood mentality and all that. And he's like, it's super interesting. And so that was nice. And then I was like, hey, do you mind if we snap a selfie? he's like, no problem. So that was fun. That was fun.
Very cool. Well, tell me, if you're willing, tell me a little bit more about the new work that you're doing, new book.
Yeah, I haven't announced it yet. It's been under wraps, but bringing together a lot of my research that I've conducted over the past decade or so of my life on vulnerable narcissism and self-actualization, and I just want people to see how a certain mentality that we have is really holding us back from realizing our full potential.
Mm.
So I'm really putting my all into that right now, and it's like running a marathon. You know, writing a book is like running a marathon. You don't get any applause for like making it half the way. Mm. No, if you make it half the way in a marathon and then you can't handle it anymore and you quit, like no one gives you any congratulations. No, you know, you have to finish the freaking marathon for anyone to notice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like writing a book. It's tough, but I'm putting my all into it, and I really believe in this topic. I believe this topic is very relevant and timely.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, in your last book, Transcend, which I loved, and you touch on vulnerable narcissism in there, and briefly as it fits into the greater picture of what you were doing in that book. But yeah, it was a super interesting topic that I could see really spending some more time on.
Cool. Yeah, I'm basically double clicking on that self-esteem chapter and making that into a whole book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then Transcend, the self-esteem chapter is like, yeah, I was like, oh, that's worth double clicking on. You know, yeah. You agree? Do you agree?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, this very interesting and important and nuanced, complicated idea of self-esteem versus narcissism and where one begins, where one ends, where they overlap, and acknowledging that we all have both of those within us, but then how do they function in our lives and how self-aware are we? So it's a very interesting topic.
It's super interesting. I noticed you have a picture of John Lennon in the background. I'm a huge John Lennon fan.
Oh, cool.
Huge John Lennon fan. Yeah, I have some original photography of him in my other room.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, I got John Lennon over there. I got Alan Watts over here, which I saw in the book. It was cool to see that Maslow was a fan of Alan Watts.
Yeah, I'm a fan of both of them. Mm. So there you go. Mm. Every generation, you know.
How did you? It's interesting because Alan Watts has had such a big influence on my life going back, maybe from when I was 18, 19, and I think Wisdom of Insecurity was the first book I read, and then I'm pretty sure at this point I've listened to every Alan Watts lecture at least once, maybe twice more. And he's had a very profound impact on just the way I fundamentally see my place in the universe and move through the world. So I'm interested to hear how his work has impacted you.
It's incredibly impacted me. I went through an existential crisis when I was starting to write Transcend. I read about that in the last part of Transcend, about how I went through this existential crisis. And, you know, Alan Watts, he says some things that are so obvious, but they're really, like, they stick with you. Like, it's hard to forget. You know, he said something. He's like, before you were born, there was an eternity that you didn't care about.
Mm-hmm.
After you die, there's going to be an eternity. It's going to be just like you're going back.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't miss it before. You're not going to miss it again. And I was like, wow, that's really insightful.
Mm. Yeah, he can ask some very profound questions along those lines. He'll ask, what would it be like to go to sleep and never wake up? And you just sit with that. You're like, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, he asks the right questions, though. You know? He asks that. I really consider them heroes of mine, these people. You know, Watts, Maslow. There's a whole period of spiritual awakening in the 60s, you know, obviously tied to drugs, but not always. You know, Maslow didn't advocate for the use of drugs, but they really had a lot of wisdom. We could use a lot of that wisdom today.
Yeah. And at least in Alan Watts' case, a lot of his wisdom and the work that he did came before he ever experimented with anything, or that was even part of the culture. And I loved his takeaway from experimenting with LSD, which was, when you get the message, hang up the phone.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting.
What does that mean to you? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I wonder about that, because like DMT opens up channels that I don't know if I want those channels opened. You know, like that's how I interpret that. Is like, you know, not all channels are conducive to growth. You know, if I'm starting to talk to aliens and they start probing me, I'm out. I'm hanging up the phone.
That's how you know you've crossed a line.
that's when I'm hanging up the phone. We all have to know our boundaries when we're hanging up the phone. I think that's a point. I could be totally misinterpreting him. How do you interpret it?
I interpreted it that there's some core insights that can come from those experiences, many of which you talk about in Transcend around peak experiences and that unitary continuum. I think what he's referencing is when you get the message that you are connected and one with the universe in some deep way, you don't have to keep taking the thing that shows you that directly. You can learn to start integrating that in a more day-to-day way, like through meditation or mindfulness or gratitude or other approaches.
That makes a lot of sense as well.
Yeah. What inspired you so much around, I mean, to take on this book of Transcend and to go through so much of Maslow's work? I mean, I know it's a big question, but it's, and maybe one more thing, it's just, it's really cool. It's like almost like a theory of everything, of human existence, reading Transcend. It touches on so many different parts of the human experience, and to see how they fit together in the cool sailboat metaphor. So how did you get into caring about this?
It was fun. It was fun writing it. I wrote a lot of it in Encinitas, San Diego, which is a very hippy dippy town, right there, the Self-Realization Fellowship. I was teaching at Penn a course in positive psychology and really fell in love with humanistic psychology once I started going down that rabbit hole and looking at the history of the field of positive psychology, who were some of the seminal founders of it. Really became captivated by humanistic psychology. And then I really became captivated by the writings of Abraham Maslow. They really sang to me, really, really sang to me. And I read all of his journal entries, his personal diary, two thousand pages. I mean, it's a lot to read, but I really felt like I got him. The way he thinks is very similar to the way I think.
Yes. So there's something about that just really clicked in for you. Similarly to maybe how I felt about Alan Watts and reading his books and listening to his lectures, or something that really just connected with something you needed to hear, the way you saw the world.
I think that's right. Yeah. And a lot of people.
Yeah.
A lot of people really connected with Watts. Probably more than Maslow.
Would you be willing to give a little just summary or overview of the sailboat metaphor?
Sure. Maslow originally had his pyramid. That's how it's often depicted, but he never drew a pyramid. And I thought the spirit upon which he really had about self-actualization is that we have security needs and we have growth needs. And we're constantly going back and forth between feeling really insecure and lost and low self-esteem, you know, like, or uncertain self-esteem, and then choosing growth and getting outside our comfort zone and trying to be the best that we can be. And so we're constantly going back and forth between these different modes of human existence. And a sailboat, to me, illustrates that. It's a better metaphor than a pyramid. because you have the boat itself, which comprises security. And if you have too many holes in the boat, you're going to sink. But if you feel safe and secure, you're still not, you're not going to go. That's not it. Your journey is not done. You're not going to go anywhere unless you open up a sail and become vulnerable to the winds and the waves and the sea, other boats. You know, we're all in this together. And you have to have a clear vision of what port you're sailing to. That's purpose. So for me, the sail represents growth, and the boat represents security. And we need both, and we need to integrate both into a whole person.
Mm-hmm. That's so cool. Yeah, reading this book and the way you describe the sailboat and move through all the different sections really made me recognize the overlap between this and the type of therapy that I work from often, that I know you're a fan of, and then ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. There's a lot of overlap in terms of the focus of living well and not feeling good, and the way that pain and growth can live together.
They often coexist. I'm a big fan of the field of post-traumatic growth.
Yeah.
I mean, pain is not always... It's like people are trying to maintain a sort of positive feeling, sense of feeling all the time. And, you know, there's such a market for that. You know, scrolling through Instagram, there's no shortage of people claiming to help get you back into a happy state of feeling. But that's boring.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's very often the pursuit of feeling good and being happy, it makes your world pretty small.
It does make your world pretty small. And it, you know, the full vitality of life involves a richness and a quality of consciousness that appreciates that fullness.
Mm. Now that you've done so many different things in your career, where do you find those boundaries are for you, where you're having to meet where growth and discomfort pair up and you have to work through that?
Well, I like discomfort. I really like getting into challenging situations where I know I'm going to grow in some way. I recently went through quite a bit to get my motorcycle license, but I just finally obtained my license. And, you know, and that took a lot of looking ridiculous. And, you know, I failed the first safety test, you know, more than anyone in the history of their organization. You know, like, that's what they told me. It was also the first time I ever set foot on a motorcycle as well. So I just jumped into the deep end, and I knew that it would be a colossal failure.
Wow.
I suspected it would be. But I eventually passed through the intermediate course. I just think that's I enjoy that. I don't like taking the easy route to things. I took myself out of special education when I was in ninth grade. I felt like it was that label was too much of a crutch. And it was giving me untimed tests, free this, free that. And I didn't want it. You know, I did not want to live life through the easy route. So, I don't know, I think this might be answering your question.
Yeah. No, it sounds like it's throughout your life, it's been this even implicit drive in you to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely this implicit drive. And
do you think that's implicit in every human, and then some people just things get in the way of recognizing that? Or do you think it's something you have to really build and work at?
I think that it's like all things. There are individual differences that some things come more naturally than others. Other things, there's individual differences in the extent to which you have even resiliency. Or you have, you know, I'm an HSP. You know, my whole life I've had to come to terms with the fact that I feel things very deeply, And working with that as opposed to working against that has been something that's been very helpful to me. I mean, these temperaments, these genetic proclivities we have, do not determine our fate in life if we, as long as we don't allow them to.
Yeah, finding the way to integrate them and move with them.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
What does being an HSP mean for you personally?
Well, there's a positive framing of that, and there's a less positive framing of that. Elaine Aron, who I adore, who invented the concept, started investigating it. She puts it in very positive terms, which I love. But, you know, having a realistic... I'm not answering your question whatsoever.
Okay.
I'm not at all. I'm not at all answering your question. Sensory processing sensitivity, at its core, it's having a heightened response to all things entering your senses.
Mm-hmm.
It can be intellectual ideas that you want to digest more in a nuanced, complex fashion. It could be emotions. You feel things deeper, the lows, you feel the highs. Everything is like a little bit on a hyperdrive. And that's what it means to me. And it has its benefits and its curses. I don't think any trait is a universal good. Sometimes I do see self-identified HSPs on HSP forums talking about themselves like they have superpowers and, you know, other people just don't understand how brilliant they are and woe is me, you know, that I'm not appreciated for my genius HSP skills. I don't know how beneficial that way of thinking is either. At some point, you got to integrate with the world and meet people on their own terms. You can't expect everyone to tiptoe around you and be a mind reader that, you know, an emotions reader that, you know, people don't know what you're feeling, you know, like you've got to take responsibility for that and let people know when you want them to know.
Mm. Yeah, no, I definitely agree. There is that spectrum of how that impacts people. I have people close into my life or clients where, you know, the distress that can come from one end, the other side is a very unique way to appreciate art or some type of music, and they kind of go together, and there's ways that you can honor both of those and have it move with you in your life.
You seem like a bit of an HSP. Would you say that's right?
I don't know. I guess it would be, let me answer honestly. I don't know. Is it a binary thing? Is it a continuum? I've never really explored that personally, to be honest.
I don't know. I mean, you strike me as an HSP.
Mm.
I get that vibe from you.
Oh, well. Yeah, maybe. I mean, there's some of the ways on the end of how it's helped me is I feel like there are times when I'm performing music or at a concert where there is this way to sink into the experience of it that does feel like a little bit of a transcendent or peak experience. And so I don't know how much that overlaps with being an HSP, but I feel like I have ways that I can slip into certain sensory experience that can be really meaningful for me.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Something I've heard you say on a podcast going off of, I think it reminded me of what you were just saying. I've heard you say that there can sometimes be a correlation between self-proclaimed empaths and narcissism.
Vulnerable narcissism.
Yeah. So would you be even, now that that topic's here again, could you describe that, what that is, in a little bit more depth? What is vulnerable narcissism?
This pervasive sense of entitlement based on your past history of suffering or your perceived fragility.
Mm.
How much do you feel a sense of fragility for yourself? And does that make you feel like you're entitled to special privileges?
Mm. And is this a newer concept? Like, 'cause most people have heard of more of the grandiose narcissism. And I would think that many people have never heard of vulnerable narcissism. Is this something newer?
It sure is. Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
So how'd this come to be more known?
I mean, there were psychoanalytic theorists who talked about it even in the 40s, 30s, maybe even 20s. Mm-hmm. Winnicott. Kohut. There are a bunch of psychoanalytic theorists who talked about it, but only in the past 20 years or so, 10, 20 years ago, did personality psychologists start to study it as a general personality variation that people can differ on in their lives and distinguishable from grandiose narcissism, which is what everyone thinks of when they think of narcissism. Grandiose and vulnerable, though, are deeply intertwined. Those who show this grandiosity of entitlement, when things aren't going their way, they can spiral downward and feel and appear very vulnerable. It's kind of like a cycle. We all have our sociometers calibrated in different ways, and some people have their sociometer calibrated so that when they perceive high social value for themselves, they'll shoot very high and up in self-esteem. But if they feel the slightest sense of rejection coming on, they spiral downward very quickly in self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want that. You don't want your sociometer beats that sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
That's too sensitive.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to there being a more reliable baseline that might move a little bit depending on successes or failures, but not something that has such drastic differences.
Dependent on the validation of others. People are so dependent on the validation of others these days. It's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it can be a very easy thing to get swept up in where you're constantly evaluating yourself based from the outside in.
Yeah.
Where does that come from? I know you touched on in the book that there can often be a root of trauma or from not having proper space in your childhood for your own emotions or your own needs. So maybe you could speak a little bit on what we know about where that comes from.
Well, like everything, there's a mix between nature and nurture. Oh, excuse me. I'm not bored with this interview whatsoever. I did not get good sleep last night.
Oh no, my self-esteem, Scott. It's tanking. You know what that yawn just did to me?
This would be an exercise for you.
It's an exposure exercise. That's actually not a bad idea. I do a lot of exposure work clinically. Like maybe some people cool. struggle with something like that. I could just yawn in the middle of them talking.
Yeah. See how that I am enjoying this interview very much. Like everything involves people always ask, where does it come from? Everything freaking comes from nature and nurture. It's like, I don't know. I'm a little critical of some therapy approaches that are just like all about your childhood. And like, I love the guy. I love Gabor Mate. He's great, but he's like, dude, he'll be talking about like people who are anxious in their lives. And he's like, it's because they were not hugged by their mother. Their mother did not hug them. It's like, brother, genes matter.
Mm-hmm.
that neurotic ass mother gave those neurotic ass genes to the son. Just say it. Just keep it real. Not everything's about the mother's fault. She didn't hug the child. It's like, no, there's nature and nurture for everything. Now, vulnerable narcissism is the same thing. You often see vulnerably narcissistic children. One of their parents tends to be, you know? You see it. You see it. what we often see is one of the parents is full on borderline, and then the child got the watered down genes, so they're not full on borderline, but they're vulnerable narcissism, which is strongly correlated with borderline, but it's a watered down version. intense sensitivity to rejection is a core feature of vulnerable narcissism, as well as shame, that emotion all the time. My answer to that is it's a combination of the genes you inherited, being raised in an environment with a vulnerable narcissistic parent who makes you feel even more insecure.
Yeah.
It's like that's a cocktail mix to develop into a highly neurotic person. But I really think we can change. We can grow. I mean, I don't mean to sound pessimistic. It's good to have a realistic understanding of where things come from, but also recognize that, you know, when we become adults, we can steer the boat in the direction we want to steer it. And that's why I'm a self-actualization coach.
Yes. No, I totally agree about your point about sometimes there being an overemphasis on the past. And there's this alluring idea that if you can just get back into the past and pick something out like a thorn in you, then everything will naturally clear up in your present life. And maybe there is some of that in maybe some of the promising work we can do with psychedelic assisted therapy. There's ways to directly do that to a degree, but at a certain point, especially in psychotherapy, I feel like we have to kind of learn how to wake up into the present moment of our lives and get in touch with what matters to us right now and get enough distance from all the stuff pulling us around in our thoughts and feelings and really just choose a direction that matters to us. And sometimes this past stuff works itself out in the process.
Well, one of my favorite quotes comes from Irvin Yalom, who also happens to be one of my favorite psychologists of all time. And, you know, he says, sooner or later, you have to give up all hope for a better past.
Mm.
And it's a quite a profound quote. And really, that forms the basis of my next book, really. That quote, that singular quote forms the basis for the whole book. But I think it's really important to recognize that. Also, there's so much trauma has been a term that used to apply to 1% of the human population. Now everyone on TikTok is, you know, everyone's traumatized by everyone and everything.
Mm.
And I wonder to what extent does the word trauma start to lose meaning when everyone is traumatized by every little thing in their lives.
Yeah, it definitely has lost a little bit of its weight as a word.
You've noticed that too? Have you noticed
that? Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I like the step that has been taken to at least distinguish between capital T and lower T trauma. That helped maybe take a step towards some more clarification of the terminology.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
No.
They talk about micro traumas. Why put the word trauma to it? You know, like what is served by keeping the word trauma in there? You know, micro annoyances,
yeah.
Or everyday new nuisances.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that people are trying to sell books.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's tough to know when we look back. We're all going to have experiences that we can categorize as negative and that had an impact on our lives. And at what time do we go from calling it that to calling it trauma? I think sometimes people are inclined to make the leap towards bringing in that word in maybe a little prematurely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I think that it's just become a buzzword now. You know, everything's become therapy language has permeated pop culture now. So everyone's gaslighting everyone. Everyone's toxic. Everyone's a narcissist. You know, I'm surrounded by narcissists. Everywhere I look, there are narcissists. But I'm not narcissistic whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I'm the angel. I'm the angel. Everyone else around me are toxic. You know, there's just so much that has seeped into the culture of this kind of mentality that, like, no one's taking any responsibility for their own being.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. There is this way that people throw out certain words like gaslighting or calling other people narcissists or using the words like toxic, that they're kind of these big, it's got a ton of energy around it that kind of colors a whole situation and wraps people's minds into something that dismisses the nuance or dismisses that person's role in the situation and how maybe they're also being toxic or narcissistic or gaslighting. And it can be really dangerous to just throw words like that out there and then hope everybody jumps along into that reality where that's truth.
Very well said.
Yeah, with clients, I mean, you know, of course there are cases of people truly being abuse victims by narcissists, and that's a real thing. And I've worked with clients like that. But when maybe it's people throwing it out in lighter dynamics that really both people are taking part in, it's helpful to at least sit with those very same things that we're calling out in somebody else. Are there places in our own being, if we really open up and are honest with ourselves, where we're doing the same thing? And if we can at least start from that place where this is something we're both doing together rather than me versus you, it's a more honest place to start.
100%. 100%. Mm-hmm. You should start a podcast.
Self-esteem's back up.
I think you'd be good at that. I think you'd be good at that.
Yeah, self-esteem's back up, Scott.
Good. I'm glad. You'd be good at it.
Well, thank you. That's a very nice compliment. And I love doing this. I mean, you're the podcast OG. You've been doing this. You're coming up on 10 years. What's that been like for you?
I know. I have a lot more gray hair than when I started. That's for damn sure.
Well, at least you have hair left.
You know, fair enough. Fair enough. How old are you?
I'm 30.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. So what's that like? The past couple of years I say like, oh, I'm gonna retire this thing, you know, next year. It's like I've gone every week for the last 10 years doing the same thing, you know, like talk about consistency, you know. But it's like, okay, you know, I have arguably the number one psychology podcast in the world. Like that's, you know, something that took a long time to build, something that took a lot of care and work. I'm not so ready to throw it away, you know? And so I keep going. I keep going. And we're starting now with iHeartRadio very soon. We just got a deal with iHeartRadio and trying to think of new and fresh avenues and sub-series to try to keep it fresh. But, you know, it can be hard doing the same thing every week, you know, for 10 years and never had a break. Every week.
Yeah, that is commitment.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't committed to anything like that in my life. That's the most commitment I've ever had, you know?
Wow. I'm going to open up a door, just like the inner workings of a podcast, but I guess that's interesting to me is like, how does it work for you? Are you just, as you read new books or you're open to you see new research or new ideas, you have certain people you'd love to talk to more, or how do you decide who to talk to?
I reach out to people that I find interesting, quite frankly, you know, and there are no shortage of people I find interesting. I do get a lot of pitches. I get like so many pitches. Everyone has a new book out. They're like, oh, I have a new book out, you know, kind of, and it's like, you're going to be on everyone else's podcast as well. People are going to see you all over the place. You know, I like people that also maybe people haven't heard of, up and comers or like legends in the field of psychology, but who aren't as well known. I love that, you know? And, I think a lot of it though are people that I personally find interesting.
Do you have any dream guests? Is there anybody that you'd love to speak with or have an interview with that you haven't?
Abraham Maslow. Oh,
the AI version that comes out.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you mean alive?
Yeah. Or yeah, I guess it could be anybody, but these are like some classic dinner party get questions. Who would you want at your
there are a bunch of people I really want to talk to. I want to talk to Mel Robbins. Mm. I've been trying to get her on my show for ages.
Mm.
I really like her.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know who she is?
Mm-hmm. I think my mom likes her podcast. She has a podcast, right?
Yeah. A lot of moms like her.
Yeah.
But I like moms. No, I'm joking. I'm joking.
Oh, man. Well.
Oh, man. Oh, Scott Barry Kaufman. What am I going to do with you?
This is, this is a hard place to pivot out of, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah. I'm a little cheeky.
Yeah. Well, like I said before we started recording, those qualities in you were things I admired when I first started listening to the podcast almost 10 years ago now that inspired me to go into the work that I do.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really me. I really am so happy to hear that. That's that makes it all worth it then.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool.
Write a review. On iTunes. No, I'm joking. I'm being silly. But you that means a lot.
You could put it on the front of your website.
Yeah. Scott's weirdness inspired me.
And then maybe you'll get Mel Robbins.
I really hope so. I hope I can get her someday.
Yeah. Mm. Well, let me see. I had some questions for you. A topic I thought was really interesting reading your book was this idea of D love versus B love. Maslow loved those D and B and using the letters. Would you explain what the difference between D love and B love is?
D is deficiency, loving people from a place of deficiency, of need, being very needy and really wanting to fill some hole in your soul. But being love is love for the being of others, people on their own terms, admiring. And usually with being love, love grows. It doesn't reach satiation, but it grows. And it's in my view, more spiritual and unconditional.
Mm. Can you, is that something people can move in and out of, both of those types of love?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
This is the thing, it's not a pyramid where you reach certain levels of needs and then you can't ever go back. The whole point here is that we, throughout the course of a day, we might cycle through 50,000 different emotions and insecurities, and you have to just keep choosing the growth option. You know, if you did a couple things in your day that were the growth-oriented choice, good for you, you know?
Mm.
It doesn't mean that you didn't spend the rest of the day wallowing in self-pity.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, we are constantly in flux between all these different parts of ourselves.
Yeah.
You mentioned the word spiritual there. When thinking about Maslow's work and the sailboat and how when we can integrate all those different needs, there's openings for these more transcendent states of being, which I think shares a common denominator with the spirituality. Where do you see the connection between transcendence and spirituality, if at all?
It can be a very spiritual experience, reaching a transcendent state of consciousness. But I don't think all transcendent states of consciousness are necessarily spiritual.
Mm.
You know, when we get into the flow state, which I view as a transcendent state of consciousness, not necessarily a spiritual experience. You know, if you're reading a book and you're deeply absorbed, would you describe that as a spiritual experience all the time? I probably wouldn't say it is all the time. But I think that when there's a greater sense, we start moving up the oneness hierarchy, you know, to like all things being one, it starts to feel more like a spiritual experience. Not just you being one with the task you're engaging in, but becoming one with all your fellow humans. And becoming one with the universe, and becoming one with with the divine, whatever the divine looks like for you. You know, I feel sadness for those who never seek union with the divine force.
Yeah, with a state of consciousness or awareness outside of the little person in your head chattering on all day, and just like a step away from experience to be able to transcend that and open up to a greater sense of being is a really profound place to get to. And yeah, I guess it is kind of sad to not be able to tap into that at all.
Because there's something there. There really is something there that we don't scientifically fully understand. Physics doesn't fully understand it. No one does. Religious people don't even fully understand it, even though they think they have it all figured out sometimes. But there's something there that when you take certain substances, when you do certain kinds of meditation, you get a certain state of consciousness, things snap into place and suddenly the universe makes sense to you. That's incredible. That's incredible that something as complicated as the universe can all of a sudden make sense to this mortal brain. You know, it suggests there is a frequency upon which when we can tune into, we realize that our brain is part of the universe. And that realization is really profound. We're not separate from it.
Yes. Yeah, and you can really experience...
You know what I'm saying?
100%. And you can really experience that directly. It's not just a collection of words like we're doing now. There's a way where you can merge into that in a really profound way.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. And I love shared spiritual experiences. I don't like isolation. I like the idea of people coming together and experiencing and vibrating on the same frequency together. I think we could use a lot more of that in the Middle East right now. We could use a lot more of that all around the world. People who have a lot of hate for each other, I think sort of all vibrating on a similar transcendent frequency, you know, put transcendence in the water supply.
Yeah, to connect with the place where we're the same, not different.
And it's such a shame that, don't get me started on this, but it's such a shame that you have people who are in some of the most spiritual locations in the world and are wasting that through hate.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and maybe it's good we're towards the end of this time, because that's a whole separate hour, huh?
Whole separate lifetime.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time and doing this with me.
It was my pleasure. I really liked your vibe.
Oh,
I don't respond to many people these days who send me I'm not doing many podcasts right now, but no, I really like your authenticity, your own genuineness. Is really well noted.
That really does mean a lot to me, honestly. Yeah. I appreciate you taking the time and doing this. Like I said, you've been a big inspiration for me, and so this is something I've been looking forward to so much.
Wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks again.
It's got me out of my mind. It's got me seeing trees breathe. It's got me learning how heaven and hell are both inside of me. It's got me feeling the love that I bottled so deep, when the entire world kept feeding on my greed. My eyes, take a deep breath and try to open my soul. yes, I know, I'll never know. But I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul. Oh, yes, I know, I'll never know. But I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul.